You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom-targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today, we're interviewing the author of The Great Plant-Based Con, Why Eating a Plants-Only Diet Won't Improve Your Health or Save the Planet. In part one, we looked at the fallacious idea that plant-based eating is necessarily superior to a diet that incorporates animal protein. And also we looked at some of the flaws in the environmental argument that this move will save the planet. Jane, for the record, you are not a pure carnivore. You incorporate plant-based foods in your diet. What are you having for dinner tonight?
Well, we're having a chicken stir fry, actually. So lots of veggies, but some chicken in there and spiced up with lots of ginger and chili, you know, to make it vibrant. So, yeah. I generally eat, I probably eat meat 2, 3, maybe 4 times a week. Not always the same kind of meat, but I eat loads of vegetables as well. And I do also, I believe in having a fair amount of other animal protein, as in cheese or eggs, throughout the rest of the day. Because I think the protein element is really important.
And indeed, I mean, amps up your intake of saturated fat and cholesterol, which again, scientific research is these days vindicating. So back to the argument that powerful forces are coalescing around this initiative. You did some investigation and came up with some very interesting facts, which you lay out in The Great Plant-Based Con. So who's behind this?
Well, I think it's really important to remember that it's not some puppet master sort of driving the whole thing. So I don't talk about the con in that sense of somebody actually, you know, or of a confidence trickster. It's more like the word that you used earlier. I think you used the word piled on. So yes, lots of different interests are piling on, piling in, because they each have an individual motivation for supporting the plant-based goals. And it's the combined effect of these parties, these interests, as it were, that is creating the overwhelming con effect. So I would say that the most obvious element out of all of this, the most obvious interest, is the corporations who are backing the new vegan revolution. And they may be the new entrants, the Impossible Burgers and the Beyond Burgers, etc. Or they may be larger, well-established companies who are just launching their vegan lines, because this is like a gift from heaven for them. It's a whole new market with a lot of profitability built into it, because these products tend to be more expensive. They have higher profit margins. And of course, these companies are going to use the save the planet, save your health message as part of their marketing. But people need to be aware that is just marketing. It doesn't mean that it's true, and it doesn't mean that they even necessarily believe it. It is marketing.
Yeah, we sometimes call it greenwashing, you know, is that we cloak it with virtue because it doesn't taste that great. But hey, you know, you're doing your part for the environment.
Yeah, exactly. And then so you have other groups of people. So, for instance, the media is a really interesting one, because over here we have a newspaper called The Guardian, and it's available. A lot of people read that paper.
Very influential worldwide.
Very influential. Now, people will notice if they read it a lot, that there's quite a lot of anti-livestock coverage there. So it generally leans towards the plant-based message. There's occasionally a feature on a farmer, which is positive, but mostly it's anti-farming, anti-livestock, anti-meat. And it might surprise people to know that this the paper is funded, has received over $2 million in funding from the OPP, which is a sort of animal welfare philanthropy organization. Sure. It also received money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So, and other sources too. So these are not unbiased sources, and therefore the funding is not unbiased, and therefore the stories are not unbiased. And even though the paper is really quite transparent in the sense of acknowledging this, you do have to dig all the deep to get that acknowledgement. You have to follow the leads, follow the money, as people say. And I don't think everybody is doing that. And therefore, they're under the impression that what they're getting is a completely objective view of livestock and meat and its impact on the world. And really, there couldn't be nothing further from the truth.
I mean, after all, these foods are a version of ultra-processed foods that have a veneer of health benefits, but what they basically are constituted of are relatively cheap plant ingredients that then can be amped up through technology, through, you know, olfactory science and taste enhancement and artificial texture methods. To resemble foods that are enjoyable and palatable.
That's exactly right. So, and I think it's really just pretty easy to understand that although processed food in general, whether it be vegan processed food or normal processed food, has a lot of extraneous ingredients in it, a lot of chemical ingredients, a lot of fabricated industrialized ingredients, the vegan food will have even more of those because they cannot use any of the other more natural things, natural fats, eggs, creams, meat. So they have to replace that with something else. And that is a manufactured product. So we already know that, you know, in the United States, I think something like 60% of people's diets is now processed food. We're getting very close to that over here. It's about 50%. And there, you know, the experts are warning that we need to get this down. We need to get people eating real food. Well, the problem with the vegan revolution is it's going to move us entirely in the wrong direction. It's going to move us towards eating more of that processed food, which we already know is harmful for our health.
And actually, we can trace some of this to an individual who we see on every box of cereal that is sold across the world, John Harvey Kellogg, who established, it was kind of an evangelical movement, and he was very influenced by the Seventh-day Adventists, who are a, you know, no quibble with their religious orientation, but part and parcel of that is an orientation towards vegetarian eating. And so they're combining the religious zeal with, you know, profit motive and industrialization. He came up with Kellogg's Corn Flakes and products like that and revolutionized Americans' concept of breakfast.
Absolutely. And people may not know that the kind of proteges of John Henry Kellogg, who came up with, as you say, these plant-based products which were meant to keep people pure of thought, pure of action, right? They have a wider influence than even just appearing on our breakfast table, because he established also sort of dietitian schools. A lot of its proteges were the founding members of the dietitian movement in North America. One of them, Lena Cooper in particular, went on to write the textbook that dietitians were using for about 30 years in the first part of the 20th century. And they also continued, and then the Seventh-day Adventist influence, as it were, continued through representational and American guidelines committees. So they are having an influence that religious-based belief in plant-based eating is having a wider influence than within its own religious sphere because of its impact on guidelines and the development of policy on the back of those guidelines. And, you know, it occurred to me, again, in 2019, another influential study had come out by Marco Springman, who is a well-known vegan scientist whose study was reported to be the definitive proof that plant foods were better than animal foods for the environment and for our health, et cetera. And it was reported very widely in some very prestigious publications. And it turns out that study was peer reviewed by just one individual. Sure. And that individual was a fellow who was at Loma Linda University, which is a Seventh-day Adventist university. Mm-hmm. So we see the impact every day of something which some people might think, oh, well, that's just a religion and it's not going to influence me. But it does. It influences science.
Right. And we see that kind of ideological capture extending to the medical establishment and medical journals as well. There's a big organization that has a very respectable name. It's the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Well, who could be against that? Yeah. That's like, motherhood and apple pie. We all want, we respect physicians and we laud responsible medicine. And they have a very, very radical vegetarian agenda. And they're often called upon by the media to comment on this or that or the other health study. And mm-hmm. But they're really tainted by a great deal of confirmation bias. I mean, they're looking for ways to confirm that their thesis is right. I mean, we all do this. You know, we all, especially we who are involved in nutrition science, we tend to support the literature that upholds what our dietary choices are.
Yeah, we all do. But they are doing it from a position of incredible influence, aren't they? And also what people may not realize about that organization is only, they call themselves Physicians for Responsible Medicine, but only about 10% of them are physicians. Mm-hmm. So it is really an advocacy group. And another one which runs sort of in parallel with it is ACLM, the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, which is having a very alarming amount of influence because they too have plant-based origins. And they, for instance, have credited, they've created an accreditation scheme that allows doctors and nurses in America to watch the movie The Game Changers, which is a very much pro plant-based movie, to gain accreditation in their education, their ongoing education system. Mm-hmm. So here we have
that, you know, let me interject, you know, for every doctor to maintain their credentials, they have to accumulate what are called CMEs, continuing medical education credits.
That's
and,
right.
You know, generally it's about, you know, the latest advances in, you know, in surgery or pharmaceutical management of disease. But this passes for nutrition education.
Yes, exactly. And it's advocacy and it's in a way propaganda. The kindest thing you can say about it is it's a single point of view about nutrition, which is much disputed. So these doctors think they're getting the answer, and they're not. They're getting something which is entirely tainted. But the influence of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and ACLM, American College of Lifestyle Medicine, it surprises me. Every day there's a new example of it. So, for instance, the mayor of New York,
yes,
probably aware, yeah,
Mayor Adams,
very much in favor of pushing plant-based diets through the schools and through the hospitals. Mm-hmm. And he tweeted a few weeks ago about how proud he was that hospitals had agreed to offer plant-based meals as their go-to meal. You know, people could get other things, but they were doing plant-based as their go-to meal. Right. Now, it turns out that the person in charge of that policy in the hospital system of which he's talking is a former ACLM representative and affiliate. So there we go. We have the link.
Yeah, it's an echo chamber. It's an echo chamber. Yeah, it's an echo chamber. Yes. And I wrote at the time, I wrote a scathing editorial in my newsletter about that, because hospital patients are especially vulnerable to a negative nitrogen balance, a protein inadequacy, when they're healing from surgery or they have severe burns or wounds. Protein is precisely what they need, you know, and they don't need a breakfast of, you know, white toast with jam and a glass of orange juice with, you know, skim milk. You know, that's not what they need.
Exactly. You couldn't get worse, could you?
Right. So, I mean, it's so misguided to, it's an ideological move. And, you know, I get it, because hospital food is horrible. So what they want to do is they want to set an example that, okay, this is the kind of stuff you should use to prevent disease. Okay, maybe, you know, that's controversial, as we realize, because the actual benefits in terms of prevention are meager, if they exist at all. But then to subject hospitalized patients to that paradigm is totally wrongheaded.
It is more than wrong. It's almost criminal. It's really it's a terrible situation. And this is what frightens me about the eat less meat messaging in general, is that the people who hear that messaging and who take it on board may be the people who can least stand to do it. So I'm thinking of hospital patients. I'm thinking of elderly people who need more protein and good quality protein. I'm thinking of young women who are heeding this vegan and vegetarian message. I mean, most vegans are women.
Yep.
And we have quite a lot of them here. We're vegan central in the UK. Actually, and it's those young women who should be building bone health, fertility. Yes. They need the fat, they need the protein, and they're not getting it. And this is a health catastrophe in the making if this becomes as strong a movement as it could do, as people would like, as these advocates would like it to be.
And they even point to the mental health consequences of such a diet, you know, which is low in B vitamins and low in iron. And low in essential fatty acids, which we know are beneficial for the brain. And hey, let's face it, we're seeing a pandemic of mental health disorders, especially in younger women. Gen Z kids are showing up on medication in record numbers.
Absolutely. I mean, I interviewed a dietitian, naturopath, called Lucinda Miller, who works with a lot of young women and young people. And she said that there's evidence that the onset of mental illness, anxiety, and even, you know, suicidal thoughts is in clinical work is often linked to the beginning of a vegetarian or vegan diet, because it's such a shock to the brain in that sense. And in young people in particular, they're very vulnerable to that. I mean, if you look at even just two nutrients, DHA and EPA, which are not available in plant foods, they are so critical to brain health and brain function and brain development. I just don't know how anyone can think that the healthiest of brains can be formed without access to those nutrients.
So we're not going to solve all these problems in the remaining couple of minutes allocated to us. But in part four of your book, you talk about potential solutions, some preferable ways to go about this. So let's summarize.
Yeah, so I guess the big summary message in that chapter is you can get a long way towards healthy eating by just eating real food. So real food is, you know, food that you recognize, food your grandmother would recognize, food that doesn't come out of a package. Or if it is out of a package, it's, you know, a couple of tiny ingredients that you can replicate at home. And I think that there's a doctor here called Dr. Jenkinson, who's worked a lot with diabetic and obese patients, and he calls it the greengrocer, butcher, fishmonger diet. So, you know, you're going to these three places to get this very real food that you recognize. And then I think beyond that, choosing food for the nutrients that it provides is a good idea. And depending on your tolerance for carbohydrates, I think watching the carbohydrates is also something which will benefit most people. So I think we do have different tolerances for carbohydrate,
which is typical on a plant-based diet. I mean, this is one of the, I think, the flaws associated with a plant-based diet is that when a diet is bereft of protein and fat, one tends to emphasize carbohydrates, and that may ultimately be a bigger problem.
Absolutely. So, which is why I think that, you know, you being a doctor, you'll know this better than I do, that we have different enzymes in our stomachs which allow us to process the carbohydrates. And so, if you're one of these fortunate people who can eat lots of beans and rice to get your protein, and you maybe can process all those carbs, and you won't feel bloated and you won't feel strain. But if you're not, then you're going to feel a lot of gastro distress. And that's why one of the main complaints that people give when they give up a vegan diet is they couldn't stand the bloating, the gastro distress. It's very uncomfortable for people.
Indeed. But the big argument, and this is along the lines of, you know, the Bill Gates Foundation, is that we're headed for planetary catastrophe because we need more efficient methods of agriculture to feed the planet. We need these vast tracts of land that are harnessed with artificial fertilizers and so on, and industrialized methods of farming to feed the masses, especially in underdeveloped countries. It's unrealistic to think that we can have, pasture-fed, 100% grass-fed organic beef to feed the growing world's population.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of problems with that form of analysis, I think. First of all, the idea that we don't have enough food to feed the world now is a misnomer. We do have enough food, it's just not distributed in the right way. And the distribution of that food is to do with politics and economics and wars and that kind of thing. So the idea, there's a certain amount of scaremongering which goes with this, we've got to feed the world rationale. The other thing that I think is limiting about that perspective is, although it is claimed that moving to more pasture-fed, regeneratively raised meat, for example, would not provide enough, the experience of farmers on the ground says the opposite. So the experience of farmers on the ground says that if you manage your land properly and you're moving, you're using those best regenerative techniques, you can increase your stocking rate. You can produce more food per unit of land than you could before. So I think we need to start listening to the farmers. I think we're paying way too much attention to what I call the modelers, who are creating these massively complex models, which and everybody bows down in front of them as if they are definitive, when really they're just models. They're models based on inputs, and they're only as good as the inputs that you put in and the assumptions that you make. And we need to start balancing that out with the actual real experience of farmers around the world who are doing this, and they're managing to create more food from the same land.
Indeed, and that's a hopeful message that you conclude your book with. I recommend it highly. It's an evidence-based debunking of the benefits of a plant-based diet, which you're going to hear so much about, and it's a way to push back against the narrative. The title is The Great Plant-Based Con, Why Eating a Plants-Only Diet Won't Improve Your Health or Save the Planet. The author, Jane Buxton, and you've got a website, Jane, at janebuxton.com?
Jane Rees Buxton, that's my middle name. R-E-E-S is middle name, yeah.
Okay, and just if you Google Jane Buxton, it's spelled B-U-X-T-O-N, you'll get there. The book is available, usual sources. It originally published in the UK. Is there a U.S. edition?
The U.S. edition is actually coming out in January. The hardback edition is coming out, available on Amazon.com. At the moment, the US, you can get digital or audio, or you can order it via amazon.co.uk or one of the other Amazons around the world. There's just been a bit of a delay in getting that hard copy into the United States.
Okay, great stuff. We really appreciate your work, and I think you've really put it all together in The Great Plant-Based Con. Thanks, Jane Buxton, for joining us.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations.